Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix. From AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
And welcome to the ATS Mix. I am Johnny Anonymous. Dave, are you with me? Dave? Dave?
Well, I'm sorry, John. We've got a Hurricane Dolly hitting towards Corpus Christi.
Oh, my goodness. Is everything okay?
Other than I can't continue to do that and talk at the same time.
Yeah, those are great sound effects, by the way.
Thanks. I've been practicing. Yeah, we have a hurricane coming down towards this way in Corpus Christi. It's supposed to hit before the show gets put up, but we'll see. And I may go out in the middle of a hurricane, John, just to see if what you told me is true.
About it being so silent?
Yeah, but I'm going to have a few Coronas before I try it.
Yes. Well, since
we got a hell of a show, don't we?
It is a jam-packed show. In fact, let's not wait any longer. Let's tell everybody real quick who we have on. Of course, we've got our international UFO sightings.
Yeah, and then we have a real unusual skeptic overview show. We don't have a skeptic. but Johnny and I soldier on, as they say.
That's right. And then we wrap it up with a fantastic interview with co-author of the book, The Hunt for the Skinwalker. He is KLAS-TV award-winning reporter George Knapp. I almost screwed that up.
The Georgianator.
Yeah, and he does a great job. And real quick, before we get into our show, I want to remind everybody that if you live in California and get a chance to stop by the DoubleTree Inn in San Jose Thursday through Sunday, that'll be July 24th through, what is it, the 27th or so, the MUFON Symposium is going on down there, and I am going to be down there. It's going to be a lot of fun. So let's get on to our show, shall we?
Let's rock and roll, babe.
This is ATS Mix.
What? Whoa, what am I hearing?
What is this?
From AboveTopSecret.com.
Oh, crap!
Here are your anomalous sightings
from around the world.
This is Tamaril from Godbog's Cafe with sightings from across Canada. And I do mean across Canada. Starting with the East Coast in Millville, Nova Scotia, at 2 a.m. on July 6th, a witness who, until this first-hand experience, was completely skeptical of any UFO phenomena, was out in his yard on a clear night, checking on his dogs, when he looked up to see a very large white ball of light flying horizontally across the sky. It made no sound, was moving slower than any commercial aircraft, and glowed more brightly than any other object in the sky as it slowly maneuvered out of his field of vision. Earlier that same night in Windsor, Ontario, at 10:25 p.m., two witnesses observed blue and red circular objects hovering and spinning, one above the other, for 15 minutes to the east, high overhead. The viewer who submitted the report described the circular objects as simply appearing in the sky rather than traveling in a specific direction. These were soon joined by other objects which were moving towards them, at which point the flashing lights vanished. Lastly, in Vancouver, BC, at 12:30 a.m., two witnesses spotted a flashing green orb in the sky while driving on the UBC Highway, 1 kilometer west of Dunbar. The witnesses came to a stop and exited the vehicle to continue tracking the orb. It was located in the southwest area of the sky, about 45 degrees, and the size of a dime from their vantage point. After 10 minutes, it disappeared, only to reappear for another 5 minutes or so. At one point, the observers reported the orb had split into two, then rejoined to form a singular green object sprouting a vertical tail. At 12:45, after dropping off his friend and heading homeward, the witness, reporting, received a call on his cell from a private number, only to hear a strange series of high-pitched tones with background static, lasting 10 seconds before going dead. A minute later, the friend he had dropped off called to relay an identical experience at precisely the same time. To further add to the mystery, the reporter had a cell number not previously in use, and no one apart from the friend with him that night had the number. This is Tamaril from Godbox Cafe, keeping my eyes to the skies for AboveTopSecret.com.
These are the reported sightings over the United States. This is David C. In Texas, a viewer spotted a reddish object, top to bottom in length, more so than side to side, in the distance that was alone in the horizon apart from any other stars, moon, or sun. It appeared to be larger than the planet Mars when viewable, but as mentioned, longer from top to bottom. It was very discernible from any trees or building objects and was viewable unobstructed for the full duration of 5 to 7 minutes. After spotting the object, the viewer then noticed what apparently was a plane following the same direction with a short vapor trail that was obviously a reddish coloration, very distinct from the typical white. It was easily in contrast to the bluish near-dusk sky. It continued in the same direction of the initial object for approximately 3 to 5 minutes and eventually became smaller to the point that it became the same size as the initial object. As mentioned, it was initially spotted to be similar to your typical plane with a vapor trail, only distinctly reddish in color and shorter in length. The trail maintained existence until the object eventually became the same size as the initial object and then disappeared. This was far and beyond any interpretation of a plane with its vapor trail or any other way of the sun reflecting off the coloration of a white vapor trail. It was extremely distinct and short in length, almost to the point of a large flame projecting from the object as opposed to a vapor trail. Also in Texas, an observer heard a loud whining noise sounding directly overhead of the garage where the viewer was working. The viewer walked outside holding a 3 million candle power lamp when he looked up at the right side of the garage, directly overhead and approximately 10 feet away or so, and saw a triangular-shaped object. The object was approximately 12 feet by 12 feet by 12 feet for all three sides. It had three red lights, one in each corner of the triangle and one white light in the center, approximately 12 inches in diameter. The white light was not very bright. The viewer stated, "I could not make out the sides, color, or top of the object in terms of shape and size. I do remember that the object was stationary over my head, and then it rotated and maneuvered across my neighbor's property, flying over the top of their tool shed. The object was able to maneuver over short trees in the backyard and around bigger trees. The object maneuvered from the backyard to my neighbor's back door. It came within 3 to 4 feet of the ground at times. When I got to my neighbor's back door, the object maneuvered to the top of the roof of their house and went over the top of the roof out toward the street and out of sight. The sighting lasted about 15 minutes. This is David C., reporting for AboveTopSecret.com.
And now it's time for a different view. This is the Skeptic Overview.
And this is a very special edition of the Skeptic Overview. Why is it so special, Dave Rabbit?
I will tell you exactly, John and Ader. It's special because we don't have a Skeptic Overlord.
That's right. But it's still going to be a Skeptic Overview of what's hot throughout the week.
Yeah, and I mean, we played the music and everything. It's homage to the skeptic. He had, something come up and he couldn't make it. So we're gonna, as he says, soldier on. So, John and Ader,
yes.
I'll let you play Top Gun, the top notch, the A number one guy. You play Bill's part, and I'll play all the others.
All right. Well, to start things off, though, I think what would be apropos would be to do a kind of a what they call a callback.
And I love callbacks.
Yes, and
is this the one where we made a guy a girl?
That would be absolutely correct. We accidentally. Well, let's set this up. Last week, we were talking about a moderator by the name of Nevermore, who came up with a wonderful thread about everybody being tired. In fact, we even mentioned how, yes, this is true, because even yours truly had mentioned the week prior to last week's episode, mentioning right. about how tired he was, as I talk about myself in the third person.
Yeah, I love that when you do that. and I also would like to interject, John, I know you're going along the same path, and I listened back to it after I downloaded it for over 3 hours on dial-up. You know, Bill says, quote, one of our female moderators, and then he starts pausing, says, well, I think Nevermore is female, and then you and I, because we're wanting to support the boss, we figure he knows more than we do, because we've never asked the sex of our fellow mod squatters, and we're going, yeah, she's female.
Well, actually, I think in between that, before that happened, I even questioned him. I think I said, are we sure that Nevermore's a female?
Oh, Oh, yeah, I think that's when I said, yeah, she's a... Yeah, okay. Well, I didn't, you know, I was hoping maybe Nevermore, you know, maybe didn't catch that. But we publicly apologized and privately apologized about 10,000 times with Nevermore.
Besides all the U2Us that we got from everybody telling us...
Oh, did you see Justin?
Yes.
Did you see Justin Case?
Yes.
Keep your ass in your own show, boy. Come over to our territory and start pointing out that we screwed up.
Well, what's going to be interesting is I believe that even Justin and his British co-part in crime is going to be probably mentioning something about that in their show. So that'll be interesting to hear what they have to say about that.
Yeah, I'm just panting.
But
I can hardly wait.
Yeah, but anyway, Nevermore is a male moderator.
I think it's Nevermore, isn't it? N-E-F?
Yeah, we better make sure we get the name right now because yeah.
Way to go, John.
Thanks. However you pronounce it on which side of the street you're on, Nevermore or Nevermore is a guy who in the past has always had some very...
Provocative.
That'd be a great word. Looking avatars. And so right. On the outside premise, one might be leaning to believe that he was a she if you were to judge somebody on their avatars alone.
Yeah, and that's what sucked us. I think that's what really sucked. I think that was a selling point that sucked us all down the wrong path, John.
Works for me. Anyway, as Dave said, we have made private apologies, we have made public apologies, and now we are doing a verbal apology over the show for Nevermore. We're so sorry, dude, and we will try to be a little bit more, maybe more aware of our surroundings. But anyway.
Oh, I love that one, too.
All right. Well, that's neither here nor there, but...
It is.
But this is a great segue into a thread that popped up, and I would like to just read a little bit about this thread. It is okay. In the psychology, philosophy, and metaphysics arena, and this may be a first for the Skeptic Overview to actually come there. It's called... it was by author Carl Hungus. It is entitled... Judge a Book or a Member by Its Cover.
Yeah, I like that.
All right. Well, this is what Carl Hungus says. Again, sorry. You know, we don't really know. This isn't Hooked on Phonics here, all right, guys? We're doing the best we can. Judge a book or a member by its cover. And the poster says this. Yesterday, I was surprised to learn that Nevermore was not a woman. It kind of made me realize that I form mental images of members based off of their posting. But as it turns out, largely just on their avatar. It made me curious as to what degree other people do this. I know that when I meet someone, I always make a snap judgment on them. But when you meet someone face-to-face, you can use their image, mannerisms, eye contact, etc. to base your judgment. Here we are forced to create mental images from text and random photos. Also, it fascinates me how people's own self-image can be so different from how other people view them. I am curious if that translates to the internet as well. So obviously this is another member who was wrong about our moderator, our good dude friend Nevermore, as to his sex. The thread itself took on a life of its own, and it's kind of an interesting thread. It currently is garnering 503 replies.
Wow.
14,988 views, 27 flags, and 26 pages. Again, it is in the psychology, philosophy, and metaphysics. Please feel free to go there. I'll try to remember to have some links up here on what we discuss so that you guys can go directly to them and be able to look these threads over that we're going to be discussing for yourself. But I guess I want to ask you, Senior Rabbit, are you one of those type of people that has a tendency to judge a book by what its initial cover looks like?
I think everybody pretty much, you know, would have to plead guilty to that, John. I mean, it's interesting, John. Did you ever see the movie Hello, Dolly?
Well, hello, yes.
With what's her name? The
Barbara
the
Streisand?
Broad. Huh?
Barbara Streisand?
Was she in Hello, Dolly?
Yes.
What was that crazy comedy chick, not Ethel Merman, but has a big mouth. What was her name?
Carol Channing.
Thank you. Wasn't she in Hello, Dolly also?
If not the movie, I know she was on the Broadway version.
Okay. All right. Well, we've got a hurricane. I know there's another sidebar. but we have a hurricane heading towards Corpus Christi. It's supposed to hit sometime tomorrow night. Called Dolly, heading our way. So lots of fun. In addition to Dial-Up Hell, now I'm in Hurricane Hell. So.
How much more time do you have before that thing actually hits you guys?
Supposed to hit her tomorrow night. You know, what might be interesting, John, and I know we're talking about behind-the-scenes stuff, but I figure what the hell. You know, what might be interesting, John, is depending on how much time we have left for this particular show that we're doing, you know, when it slams into the coast, I could actually stand outside and give you one of those things that you always see on the Channel 4 News or Channel 8 News or where, you know, whatever your local station is, and give you a audio report of the hurricane hitting Corpus Christi beaches.
Okay. And I'll tell you what would, to me, what would be really, really cool would be that if the eye of the hurricane goes overhead where you're at.
Jump out there.
Because I understand it's supposed to be just like dead silence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, that will be fun, John.
Make sure you seatbelt yourself to the house or something, you know?
I'm so looking forward to proving your philosophy right, John. Thank you.
Not necessarily a philosophy, a theory. A theory.
All right, enough of the hurricane. What were you were going to tell me something. What were you going to tell me?
I was going to tell you about another thread.
Okay, I'd love to hear about another thread.
All right. This is by the author Scobro. I'm S-C-O-B-R-O. And could be a guy, could be a gal. We don't know.
It's could be a worm, could be a snake. Who knows?
It's in the aliens and UFOs area. It has 13 flags. Let's see here. Did I get that right? No, 13 pages. 13,
wow.
No. Yes, 13 pages, 37 flags, 23,286 views, and
wow.
250 replies. So it's no small thread.
What's it called?
It is entitled, Is My 7-Year-Old Daughter Being Prepped for Disclosure by Her School?
I saw that, yeah. What's the deal on that?
All right, this is what Scobro says. Hi, over the last couple of months, my 7-year-old daughter has been showing an increased interest in aliens, UFOs, and the like. I can recall two of her homework sheets actually depicting both aliens and UFOs. One in particular had both my wife and I scratching our heads. This particular homework sheet depicted a flying saucer landing in the school playground, and the questions being asked on the sheet seemed to be designed to gauge my child's reaction to such an event. Now, if the school wished my child to express in writing her reaction to an extreme event, then why use a UFO landing in her playground? I mean, what does a 7-year-old girl know about UFOs? Why not use a picture of a lion or something similar? Let's see what else she says. Naturally, I was a bit taken back by this statement, so I asked my daughter exactly what it is her teacher has been saying to her in class. Apparently, the teacher has said that aliens were going to be landing in Africa, Egypt, and Australia to pick something up. Of this, my daughter wasn't exactly clear about. Something to do with seeds or plants, she thought. The teacher then went on to say that after that, the alien visitors would be seen all around the world, and the children were not to be afraid, as they had come to help all mankind. Her teacher then told them that they would learn more about the subject after they returned from their summer holidays. And then, of course, the thread took off from there, members after members wanting to know if this is true, could you possibly post a scanned copy of her homework? You know, which
right.
makes sense.
Right.
You know, if you're going
right,
to make
sure.
a if you're going to make a claim like that, you know, it's like we say, if we can't right. see it, taste it, hear it, smell it for ourselves, you know, it gets passed by a lot of us.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting here. What if this turned out to be true, Dave, what would be your thoughts about it? I mean, do you think this should be something that should be discussed in, let's see, 7 years old? So what would that be, first grade maybe?
That's probably first grade, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, first grade. You know, I mean, well, I guess I'm confused, John. What is the premise? Is this person, the poster, upset about that they're doing this for on the first graders or what?
The mother just seemed surprised that the teacher would be querying the kids about their reaction about a UFO landing in the playground. And I guess the concerns are, well, now, since when is it that – are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
That something like this should be allowed would be tolerated in a school. In fact, that was what a lot of members wanted to ask, you know, if the school maybe was even aware that the teacher was talking about this and querying the children about it, and that they're pretty sure that, for the most part, this seems to be the general consensus, that the members were all curious as to why the mother didn't go talk to the teacher herself.
Yeah, I kind of lean towards, and I don't want any of the teachers that are great members at AboveTopSecret.com to take this the wrong way, but I mean, you know, I know in Dallas as an example, I know there's been several instances where we had some rogue teachers that thought it would be fun or would be interesting or whatever, and brought stuff to class. As a class participation project, whatever, to find out how people thought or whatever, you know, kind of like a survey, if you will, John. And this is just recently, this last semester of school in Dallas, there was three teachers that were suspended simply because they deviated from the set curriculum that had been approved by the Dallas Independent School District, and decided that they wanted to try some different avenues, and it turned out that some of the avenues that they were exploring, which was feelings about race and religion and stuff, and it offended some people. And boy, they didn't just go right to the teacher; they went to the superintendents and the board and whatever, and got these three people suspended. So, you know, this could be a case where you have a rogue teacher that simply just, you know, wanted to see, you know, oh, this would be fun to see if the kiddos, you know, believe in this or believe in that. And I can see where that, you know, parents would be real concerned about that, because, I mean, at what point do you stop being, well, let's see what they think. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. And, you know, kids are very impressionable at that age anyway.
Of course they are.
Although I will say that I have been noticing a whole lot more of, how can I word this, aliens and UFOs being offered in the media. And I'm talking about not just, you know, for the past year or so, we've been talking about the Energizer Bunny.
Yeah, being still being, there. I still see it today.
Yep, it's still being shown. They have not come up with a new one since that I know of.
They haven't.
It's still the aliens' saucers got problems, and the Energizer Bunny re-energizes the saucers. The saucer takes off and then comes back and then abducts the Energizer Bunny, beams it up, you know, and takes them along with it. So hide your batteries, folks.
You know what would really be funny, though, John?
What?
You know, we've talked about this literally for about a year, and you're right, in several different shows. But wouldn't it be funny in about, you know, a year or two from now, they do some kind of FBI or Secret Service or whatever thing, and they go to the Energizer plant and it's run by a bunch of aliens? Wouldn't that be a hoot?
Or
and that's the reason why they left that commercial on, because it really shows what their power source is. Wouldn't that be hilarious?
Or the aliens land, they come down and they say, "Take me to your leader," and they pull a rabbit out to. So you'll have to be careful, Dave. You'll have to be careful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because he's a rabbit, isn't he? I forgot all about that.
That's right. Yeah, he's your distant cousin.
As long as they insert the battery with the right up and down in the thing, you know.
That's right.
Minus, yeah.
We may have time for one more here, and this is going to be one I'm going to have to throw a disclaimer on. This is a very controversial subject. And Dave and I, of course, are only the mediators here. Don't shoot the messenger here as we talk about this. This is in breaking political news. It has 14 pages currently, 8 flags, 6,964 views, and 266 replies. It is by the author Dimensional Detective.
I like that guy, Arturo.
Yeah. And it is entitled, Two Gays Only Count as One Parent, Therefore They Shouldn't Be Able to Adopt, Says McCain.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. And he or she, Dimensional Detective, has a snippet. We know how you like snippets.
I love snippets.
This is from rawstory.com. The snippet says this, I think we have proven that both parents are important in the success of a family. I don't understand how this is. I think this isn't a complete snippet. I think that we've proven that both parents are important in the success of a family. So, no, I don't believe in gay adoption, McCain said in a reply to a reporter's query. McCain then remarked that he and his wife Cindy were proud to be adoptive parents of a daughter born in Bangladesh, and he encouraged others to adopt. Asked if these adopting should be traditional couples, McCain answered, yes. And so I went to the story because I wanted to make sure that I had a complete scoop. First off, I've never heard of rawstory.com. I don't know how really newsworthy they are, but apparently this is a real event that happened, and it does suggest that Senator John McCain did say this, excuse me, that he doesn't believe in gay adoption, and it mentions also that Florida outlaws gay adoptions, estimates suggest that there are 100,000 children that are in foster homes in the United States. And continuing on, it says, I think that we've proven that both parents are important to the success of the family. So, no, I don't believe in gay adoption, McCain said as a reply to the reporter's query. Then it says McCain does have an adopted daughter from Bangladesh.
Right.
And he does wish that people that are going to adopt would do so as a traditional couple. And, of course, gay and lesbian right groups,
up in arms.
Yeah, they sure did. He's completely out of touch, says Kara Sufridin, a public policy director for the Family Equality Council. There is no reason except for the sake of red meat for his base to throw up screens in the way of children in foster care getting homes. An executive director of Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays said McCain's comments were especially dismaying because more than 100,000 children are in foster care waiting to be adopted. Okay, so now before I let you go off, because I'm pretty sure you've got something to say about this, here's what I don't understand. All right. So the McCains have adopted a daughter from Bangladesh.
All right.
McCain says that he thinks traditional family couples, that's a man and a woman, should be right. The only ones allowed to adopt. And then we've also learned, just from this little bit here, that there are more than 100,000 children that are in foster care in the States waiting to be adopted. My question is this. Why did they adopt a daughter in Bangladesh and not one from here in the U.S.?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I'm surprised somebody didn't ask that.
Well, I don't know, John. Do they have any natural children between he and Mrs. McCain?
You know what? It does not say, and if it did, perhaps I just missed it.
Right.
But I'm going to have to say I don't know. But
yeah, and I don't know either.
But still, that question comes up to me. If we've got, to me, that would add a whole lot more credibility to, hey, if you're going to adopt and be a traditional couple, you should then, since you're wanting to be a U.S. president, you should adopt from the U.S., not from Bangladesh.
I can see all kinds of ramifications on this, look at Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. I mean, she adopts only kids, from overseas, So.
Okay, I understand that, but we're talking about a political figure versus two entertainment figures, So.
Well, speaking of entertainment figures, John.
Yes.
Do you know who just became the newest addition to the Lesbyterians?
The Lesbyterians? No, I. Yeah.
That's like Presbyterians, but they're lesbians.
All righty.
I found this out. You know, I don't know why it is, John. You know, I get on the internet, and of course, it always shows me. You know, especially when I'm home in my studio, how quickly it shows me. But even down here, I go to my homepage, and it gives me, you know, like the top news stories, entertainment news, and political news, and sports news, and whatever, you know. And I can click on it, and I can see pretty much all the AP things. Well, I look at stuff every day, or at least attempt to, after the pages load. And you know what I found out today that blew me away?
I give up.
Lindsay Lohan is a lesbian.
Oh, is this the first time you've heard that?
I have never heard that before.
Yeah, she's been spotted several times being in the company of female friends at nightclubs,
holding hands and stuff, right?
And hugging and kissing. I've heard about this for at least a good 3.5-4 months.
Have you really?
Uh huh.
Where the hell have I been? Now, see, here's the deal.
Well, you see, I know you love stuff like this. That's why I didn't share it with you.
And it really cracks me up, you know, that I'm behind the eight ball here when it comes to lesbian stories.
Well, you've been in dial-up hell.
Well, I know, but, you know, it just... Well, I tell you why it kind of surprises me.
All right.
I mean, I don't... Well, you know, Jodie Foster, you know, her and her lesbian girlfriend just broke up. I don't know if you knew that.
You're making this sound like... Religion meets lesbianism.
It's just a name I garnered somewhere.
Right.
I don't mean anything derogatory by it, but I just found out that, you know, Jodie Foster, you know, for years really kept close to the vest that she was a lesbian, you know.
Okay.
And I just found out through the grapevine, and my grapevine is Bunny, by the way. She gets all those Star and National Enquirer and all these other things, so she fills me on all that stuff. But, yeah, she just broke up with her longtime friend, you know. And then I find out, you know, 3 days later that, you know, Lindsay Lohan. And, I saw Lindsay Lohan in that Georgia Rule with Jane Fonda, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, man, she's hot, you know. Lindsay Lohan's hot. Now, she doesn't, you know, knock out my Marissa Tomei chick from the number one spot. But, I mean, you know, she's definitely hot. And not that that means anything, you know. I mean, if you know, I wish her well. If that's, you know, if that's the route she wants to go, it's just, I don't know. But that, you know, back to the point, John. You asked me what my thoughts were about the McCain scenario and the McCain comment. Personally, I think it sucks, and I'm going to tell you why.
This was a long way to get finally to the answer, but go ahead.
I know. But, you know, I don't know. You know, John, I mean, you and I have been friends over a year now, and I think I know you well enough to know that, you know, there's not a prejudice burning your body, and nor is there mine. Now, you know, we make comments, and we make, you know, satire things about different things and whatever. But, I mean, deep in our hearts of hearts, you know, I'm no more prejudiced about anybody than the man in the moon. You know, I can't stand prejudice, and I know you feel the same way. So... I don't see, you know, if you've got 100,000 kiddos out there that need a secure place, you know, a secure home, you know, and I can't stand Rosie O'Donnell, but, you know, from everything I've ever heard, read, or whatever, I mean, she is a terrific mother to her kids, you know. But, I mean, you know, I just don't think you can sit there and say just because someone's gay that they can't be a good parent. And the comment about two gays is equal to one parent, I think, is asinine. I mean, I just think that's an asinine statement to make. The only reason McCain's doing that is because he wants to garner the deep biblical vote, right?
Well, I don't know what his reasons are, but I would tend to agree with you that if same-sex couples wanted to adopt and they were able to go through the same paperwork and requirements as a traditional couple and be able to provide a loving home, then hear, hear, you know, good for them. They I don't know what the problem is. I was raised to believe along the same lines as you know, everything should be a traditional couple, marriage-wise. And I happen to be a, well, I'd like to say a practicing heterosexual, but it's been a while, folks. Thanks. But if I were to hook up, it would be with somebody of the opposite sex. But all if right, I were to right. live next door to a couple, a same-sex couple, and they had children, I wouldn't think any differently of them, you know, as long as they're not having, like, Wesson Oil parties out in the backyard where my kid could see it, you know. That's
I love the Wesson Oil parties.
Yeah, now I'm going into a little bit of satire there, obviously. But seriously, what you do in your own home, more power to you.
Yeah.
As long as my kid doesn't have to know about it and your kid doesn't have to know about it, then I say, hey, that's great.
Yeah, and I just think it's a little, I think it's a little bit overboard. If in fact, and you say that the documents seem to prove out that he said that, I think that's, you know, I think that's really kind of weird, you know, to be taking stances like that. You know, I mean, there's a lot of gay people in, you know, the United States that are voters, you know.
And that brings us pretty much to the close of this very special skeptic overview section. And we wish Bill all the best, and we hope that maybe he'll be able to come join us next time.
Since it's his show, it'd be nice to have him on.
So we'll look forward to having you folks listen to our next Skeptic Overview.
A-T-S Mix Featured Interview.
Well, Dave, I haven't asked you lately, but how's your secular investigation going down in Corpus Christi?
Well, I don't know about the secular, but I can tell you this. In Corpus Christi, Texas, any town that's on the coast, I don't care whether it's South Carolina or Florida or wherever, you know, when you have a Japanese restaurant, John, they need to have Japanese cooks. I'm sorry. You know, if I want hibachi, I don't want some, like, 22-year-old kid that asks me if I want my steak medium, and I say, yeah. He goes, that's cool. You know, it really kind of blew the Japanese atmosphere. But you'll be surprised, John, on the way out, I was trying to find out some information about what's going on in Stephenville, but was having no luck doing that. So maybe we can find out from our guest tonight.
Yes, and speaking of our guest, let's get right to it and tell everybody who it is we'll be interviewing today. He was born in Woodbury, New Jersey, and raised mostly in Northern California. George Knapp graduated from high school in Stockton, California. He earned a bachelor's degree in communication from West Georgia College and later earned a master's degree in communications from the University of the Pacific. He moved to Las Vegas in 1979 and landed a job at KLVX-TV Channel 10 as a part-time studio cameraman and production assistant in 1981. KLAS-TV hired him as a general assignment reporter, and he co-anchored various newscasts for Eyewitness News. Since 1995, George has been the chief reporter on Channel 8's I-Team Investigative Unit. He has won 14 Emmy Awards. Several were for his street talk commentaries, and others were for his investigative stories. 9 times he has won the Mark Twain Award for Best News Writing from the Associated Press. In 1990, his series about UFOs was selected by the United Press International as Best in the Nation for Individual Achievement by a Journalist. He's co-authored the book The Hunt for the Skinwalker with Colm Keller, which is available at www.huntfortheskinwalker.com, and George's investigative website is located at www.area51.eyewitnessnews8.com. It's an honor to have with us on the ATS Mix, George Knapp. Hi, George. How are you?
Hey, Johnny and Dave. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we really appreciate it, George, because we know how tight your time frame is. So we're not gonna banter around here. We're gonna get right to it. I find it amazing, George, and I've known about you for a long time. But I find it amazing with all the things that you've done, and I mean, God, Emmy Awards and a slew of credits that just is longer than, you know, someone's arm. What got you interested when you were a kiddo for this particular field that you've excelled so well in?
I was a reporter here in Las Vegas, and my mentor at the time, my managing editor, was a guy named Ned Day, a muckraker of great repute, a fantastic journalist who's now deceased, but he had done some stories with a guy named John Lear, and the story that Lear helped us break was the existence of the stealth fighter. Lear had told Ned Day about the stealth fighter being out at a place called Area 51. We had heard about it, of course, although few people outside of Nevada had heard about it. We'd heard the dark rumors about it and the secret programs and things of that sort over the years. And so Lear had a little bit of credibility with Ned Day, and he came into the station after doing the stealth fighter story and pitched Ned on UFOs. He said, Ned, you got to look at this stuff, this MJ-12 stuff, these documents, all the cover-up stuff. And Ned was having no part of it. He figured that his credibility would go out the window. So I was eavesdropping, as usual, and as Lear was heading out of the building, I said, hey, let me take a look at that stuff. And he gave me a pile of documents, and I'd started wading through it. Until then, I had had no interest, no active interest in UFOs. I mean, I had the same kind of curiosity that most normal people have about it, but had never done any reading to any degree. So I looked at these documents. I thought, wow, this is really interesting. I had Lear. I had him as a guest on a little public affairs program that I produced back then at the time and hosted. It was a show called On the Record, and it would air early in the morning on the weekends, and it's the kind of thing that few people ever watched, and you'd have the mayor or the city councilman come on and talk about boring stuff. But I had Lear on to talk about UFOs, and all of a sudden my phone is ringing off the hook. I'm getting letters and calls and things of this sort. And so I had him on again to tell me more about this, and the response was even bigger. I had him on a third time some months later, along with a guy named Bill Cooper, and they told me more about Area 51 and crash saucers and sort of hinted about the Bob Lazar story. And wow, the response was tremendous. And after that, I figured this subject touches the pulse of the public in a way that I really did not understand, it did not appreciate, so I decided to look into it.
One thing that Dave and I both know, being friends with John Lear, he's never boring.
No. John is, I don't necessarily subscribe to everything that John says, and I've interviewed him a number of times over the years. He's not boring. I take it with a grain of salt, and I don't think I insult him when I say that. But yeah, he's always got an interesting tale to weave.
Absolutely.
Did he ever play piano for you, George?
I'm sorry?
Did he ever play the piano for you?
No. No, I've been to his house a lot of times, but never heard him play the piano.
Okay, well, you need to have him do that.
Yeah, we did a couple of interviews with him where he says, I'll get right back to you, and then he just set the phone down next to the piano and started playing for us. And, you know, as you well know, what we really appreciate is that lolly moment called dead air.
He didn't sing for you, did he?
No singing.
No, he just put the phone down and started playing, and we're rolling, you know, and I'm going, and then Johnny and I are talking, going, well, I wonder if he realizes that we're still recording. You know, and he finishes the song and he comes back and he says, well, what do you think about that? And we said, oh, that was great. The listeners are going to love that part of the interview. So.
But something we did find out that John absolutely hates, and that is Kenny G. Has he ever told you about how much he hates Kenny G?
I don't know how I've missed it. I've known John for 20 years or so, but I've somehow missed all these interesting factoids that you've dug out of him.
Next time you talk to him, ask him about how Kenny G makes his music. I'll tell you, it is a belly roll. Getting back to Nellis Air Force Base. All right, so John has opened up the door. It's garnered your interest here. Did you end up coming up with some contacts then and some insiders from Nellis Air Force Base?
Yeah, you know, we had heard these stories. In fact, my news director, who'd been here longer than I have, had had an interest in Area 51. He'd been out there a couple of times, had got rousted by security people. This was before the flying saucer stories came out. I mean, it's an interesting place, whether they have UFOs or crashed saucers there or not. So we had done a couple of stories over the years. In particular, in the mid-1980s, there were some stories we aired about the land grab. The Air Force seized 90,000 acres of land around the base to use as a buffer zone for whatever the heck they were doing out there. I mean, they just took it, commandeered it, and then a year later they asked Congress for permission to do what they'd already done. So that was kind of an interesting time period, because everyone's wondering, well, what the heck are they up to out there? They need this much room. So I started poking around on it and developed some sources, and Lear had hinted to me about this guy that I later learned was Bob Lazar. And I tried for quite a while to get a meeting with Bob, and then sort of as an off-the-cuff kind of a thing, we had a day where an interview, a live studio interview, canceled on us, and I called Lear up and said, hey, what about your saucer guy? Would he be willing to go on the news? And he did, and we put him on the air silhouetted, and he told the basic story that the world all knows now about 9 flying discs, flying saucers stashed in hangars out at a place near Area 51 called Papoose Lake, designated S4, and the rest, as they say, is history. I mean, the reaction was tremendous. We had interest from all over the world, and it's been a ride. It's now 19 years ago, and it hasn't really slowed down. I mean, not a month goes by that I don't get inquiries, questions, stopped at a store or in a men's room or a bar or anywhere with questions about Area 51.
Did you ever get any ridicule, George, from like fellow reporters for reporting on the case?
Or any tons. Of those cases? Tremendous. You know what? I got really bad stuff from guys like you. Mostly it's not like you, but radio DJs, you know, radio guys, when they would run out of belch, barf, and fart jokes, they would pummel me. A couple of guys who wrote songs about it. And it was funny. I was featured in three different editorial cartoons in our state's largest newspaper. The first one had me an even fatter version of me with a butterfly net chasing a UFO. One was titled The Marshmallow Head Chronicles, and it had a couple of aliens that came to Earth in what looked like a little barbecue grill, and they were holding ray guns in front of two gasoline pumps, and the term was, and they were alien hitmen is what they were, and they were holding these ray guns and looking at these gas pumps saying, yes, of course they are Earthmen, but which one is George Knapp? They'd come here to blast me. Columnists have had a lot of fun with little green hookers from outer space. I did a series one time on alleged alien abductions, and the Review Journal here in Las Vegas dubbed me the grand mullah in the Church of Cosmic Proctology. There was a media columnist at the time I was doing these UFO reports, which were the highest rated TV reports of any subject ever in the history of Las Vegas. But they were saying, this guy was writing, well, gosh, everybody's coming home at night to see these reports, not because they're interested in flying saucers, but because they want to be there when George Knapp finally goes bull goose loony on the air, foaming at the mouth. So yeah, I took a lot of grief for it. I still get grief for it. Anytime that somebody disagrees with me on anything, they'll pull out a George phone home or some kind of line like that and really think they're being clever like they made it up. And I understand. I'm a public figure here in Las Vegas to some extent. Right. It comes with the territory. I don't mind it. A lot of it's very funny. But, you know, these are journalists. These are reporters. These are media people. Right. I don't mind you taking a shot at it, but do your homework. Right. If you're going to ridicule the subject. Yeah.
And this is a minor sidebar, Johnny, excuse me. But, you know, the thing that's always aggravated me, George, I don't care who it is in public life. You know, it's like you say. I mean, it's one thing for your fellow peers to make comments, and that's fine. You know, I mean, I've had, believe me, as Dave Rabbit persona, I've had more than my share over 36 years. But the point is that, you know, like you say, if they don't know the facts and they're just sitting there doing rhetoric from someone that's already done the rhetoric and done the research, then all it is just, you know, they're just perpetuating, you know, the insult. And that's what kind of ticks me off. I don't know how you feel about it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I was out there month after month, night after night at Area 51, sitting around in the darkness, waiting to see whatever I could, dodging security guards, eating dust, avoiding coyotes and all kinds of other things, and none of them were out there. Not a one of them. Not a one of them ever tried to interview the key witnesses, never did any of the basic research, not only in the Area 51 story, but the larger UFO question. It's an easy thing to poke fun at. It's hard digging into this thing. It's hard.
Yeah. Of course.
Do you think that Area 51 is still operating as it once did?
Oh, certainly. It's you know, you can watch the flights, the Janet flights that leave a couple of times a day to take people out there, as well as to the Tonopah Test Range. If you go up and sit on the dirt road, Groom Lake Dirt Road, you can watch the buses come in and out. There's a couple of places where the employees park their cars to be picked up by the buses. Satellite photos show all kinds of activity at the base. A lot of the Area 51 watchers, there are a couple of spots, vantage points, where you can still, if you have a really high-powered lens, you can still watch them out there. They've built huge new hangars, all kinds of new facilities. So, yeah, it's as active, maybe more active than ever. There was a report, as you guys know, a couple of years ago that, oh, no, the place is closed down, which was in Popular Science or Popular Mechanics. It was just a goofball report.
Science, yeah,
the guy had gone down the wrong road, found a gate that was closed. Oops, looks like Area 51's all closed down, and it was ridiculous. It's right. A multi-billion dollar facility. They can't afford to close it down. It's still very valuable to the national security apparatus, and it's very, very much active.
Well, you know, there's a lot of rumors right now, George, floating around that, you know, since your investigation, all the reporting you did on Area 51, that maybe they've moved their operations to another state. You got any information on that that might back that up?
Well, I mean, you know, I've heard this from a couple of people who've worked out there, and in addition to Lazar, I've got more than two dozen people who've given me bits and pieces of the story over the years, and I think it's entirely likely, even without people telling me that this was the case, that they would have moved anything sensitive like that, like saucers, if they had recovered ET craft, and I don't know it for a fact. I just reported some of what we found. If they had it out there, it's not there anymore. It makes no sense, because since those reports, ridiculed as they were by my colleagues in journalism, since those reports came out, I mean, the world has beat a path to Area 51's door. Every major news organization in the world has been there. Every tabloid show, every newspaper, all the major networks, the BBC, the Nippon Network, I mean, everyone has been there. And every, even today, years, 19 years later, every single day there are people out there in the desert with binoculars and telescopes looking at whatever is floating around out there. So, you know, I have no doubt that it would make sense for them, if they had saucers, to move them somewhere else. But the base itself and other top secret programs remain and are very active.
Well, you've already told us that John Lear kind of introduced you on to Bob Lazar. And before we actually start talking a little bit about Bob Lazar, I understand that if people go to your website, you have the only known 3D perspective image, a copy of it, of Area 51. Why don't you tell people about how that came about and where they can get it?
You know, that if you're talking about the KLAS-TV website, that's got to be what you mean. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm trying to think of where I got that thing. Oh, I know what it was. It was a we had worked out a deal with a television network where we provided them some material that went into the making of this 3D thing. It's like a flyover where you can actually, I think that's the one where you can actually control the flyover. They had put this together through a variety of different satellite images that they acquired. They had the help of a satellite company, a private satellite company, that took pinpoint pictures, and it's almost like you are there. It's as close as you can be to be in there, and I think that thing is still there. Is it up and running? I haven't seen it in a while.
I went to it today, and you can still download the software and still get a copy of it. So that's kind of cool, and I thought I'd mention that. Dave?
Okay, well, you know, now that we're on Bob Lazar, we've pretty much already touched on how you learned about Bob, because you heard it from John Lear. But, you know, what about the story that really garnered your interest?
What do you mean, his story?
Yeah, Bob's story. I mean,
it's incredible. It's incredible by any definition. I mean, Bob claimed that he had been hired to work out there, that he had an intro from Edward Teller, that he, from the very beginning, he started reading these classified briefing books, which had information about aliens and crash saucers and their interest in our species and their interest in us as harvesters of souls, and had pictures of aliens undergoing autopsies, things of that sort. He couldn't quite figure out why he was being shown this stuff, since he did not at that point even have a security clearance. Says he saw a saucer in a hangar. He later saw one in a test flight, and then he saw nine of them in these hangars made to look like the desert floor at a place adjacent to Papoose Dry Lake. He wasn't there for very long. It is entirely possible that, you know, maybe it was some sort of a test case or a trial balloon or something of that sort. A lot of what he says doesn't make sense. But then again, a lot of what he said does make sense and checks out. And I know that there are gaps in the story, and I know that there are problems with Bob's credibility, and I'm willing to talk about all those things because, you know, most of that, nearly all of it, was revealed in the very first report we ever did, the problems with his degrees and things of that sort and proving his background. I mean, a lot of folks have made up their minds about Bob without doing any work, and I have no respect for them. Some people, like Stan Friedman, did their own homework and followed up the same trail that I had already blazed, in essence, and found out and confirmed the same stuff I had already reported, that Bob could not really prove where he was. But you know, we can get into some details about the kinds of things that he could prove and the things that I sort of saw with my own eyes and lived through.
You mentioned that Bob claims that, of course, that he was shown some stuff, yet he did not have that type of security clearance. And so a lot of people then grabbed that and they ran with that and saying, so that must mean that he was just being a peon for the government, that the government chose him then to be, you know, whatever, to then spread more disinformation. So there's got to be something there, because somebody has apparently trashed some data and information about Bob Lazar's life. Would you not agree?
I would. Let me tell you a couple of things about this. Is that Bob is not perfect. That's for sure. I mean, he's a wild guy. I remember when I met him, he had a skull and crossbones pirate flag flying over his house. He had this jet car parked out in front. He likes guns. He likes hookers. He's a really weird character and has a lot of strange interests. So, you know, in one sense, I mean, he's a rebel. He's had trouble. In one sense, if you wanted to have somebody who had a great deal of technical expertise, a really smart guy, and somebody who could be easily discredited if that's what you wanted to do, in that regard, Bob could have been the most qualified guy in the country for that position. Sure. Obviously, there are people with better degrees, better pedigrees, better scientific credentials that go into that kind of a program. We don't know the answer to why he was there. Do I believe he was there? Yeah. Was he a puppet or some kind of a test case or something? Or I believe in my heart, and it's not just a belief, but I have basis for it, is that he was not a willing participant in any sort of disinformation campaign, because I know it. I lived through this stuff. But even Bob, in conversations that he and I have had, admits that it's possible. I'll put it this way, though, and it goes back to sort of what I was saying about the media, that if Bob was a disinformation campaign, if that they decided to run this up the flagpole and see what people thought about it, or as many people have suggested, most people have suggested, that are critics of this, they say, well, he was just there to divert attention away from something else. Well, if that was the case, then it was a miserable, miserable failure, because no matter what is going on out there, as I said, every single day there are people out there with telescopes and binoculars and TV cameras looking for whatever is flying around in the skies. And if it's not flying saucers, there's a heck of a lot of other stuff that they don't want seen. So whoever's idea of that was, if it was a disinformation campaign to deter attention, public attention, they failed, because not only the media attention and the public attention, but congressional attention. And I've worked with congressional investigators and members of Congress who've gone out there. I've briefed them to what to look for, and they've gone out there asking questions, asking very tough questions, to look around. And I do not believe that the people that run Area 51 are happy about that development.
Right.
Yeah, and I can't imagine they're happy either. And I mean, when you get right down to it, it's not only the mainstream media that has just jumped on it, and the public, obviously, in overwhelming numbers, but I mean, Hollywood has jumped on the bandwagon with, you know, just bunches of different movies, you know, Independence Day being one of the best examples, when they say, you know, you really don't think you can spend $800 for a hammer. So, I mean, I can't imagine if Bob was thrown out to the woe, so to speak, to, you know, as you say, put up a false flag or whatever. Why would they do that? Because it only garnered more attention from everybody in the world. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, it sure backfired if that were the case. And I've said it in the very first story I aired, I said it in the very first public presentation I made about this, there are parts of his story that don't make sense, and there are parts that you can't prove. The most glaring example of that are the claimed credentials, academic credentials that he had. And I don't think, I honestly don't think that he ever got master's degrees from those two schools. And I've talked to him as sort of a friend-to-friend kind of a thing. Look, Bob, now's the time to come clean. And I'll tell you, there was a time that he should have come clean, and I'll get into that in a second, but he didn't and hasn't. And at the same time where there were gaps in his story about his credentials, and for some people, they'll never get over him. If he lied about X, he could not have possibly been telling the truth about everything else, which, you know what, I think there's a lot of people in scientific circles who have lied about their credentials to get a good job, and it doesn't mean that everything they've ever done in their life is a fraud or a lie.
Exactly.
In Bob's case, there's too much stuff, and this is what the critics avoid. There's too much stuff that he knew that he couldn't have known otherwise. I'll give you some examples. One was, when are these test flights taking place of something that looks like a glowing flying saucer?
Right.
Because he took people out there for weeks before anyone had ever heard about this stuff, before we ever put him on the air, and he videotaped this stuff. And I interviewed all those witnesses. They went out. They saw these things. They look like glowing flying saucers flying over a base at Papoose Lake. Now, how did he know there was a place called S4? I confirmed with the Nellis Air Force Base, their public information office years ago, that in fact they have a couple of places called S4 out there. How did he know about Papoose Lake? You can see on satellite photos that there are dirt roads that lead down to that facility. He gave me the name of a guy named Mike Thigpen, who was a security agent who works for, he thought, Bob thought it was the FBI. It turned out to be Thigpen worked for something called the OFI, Office of Federal Investigation. Now, I'd never heard of it. They don't have a phone number in the phone book. But right. That, in fact, is the agency that does background checks for people who get jobs out at the Nevada test site and at Area 51. That's what they do. And, in fact, when I tracked them down, they had a guy named Mike Thigpen who worked there. How did he know? How did he know the tests were taking place, that there was a place called S4? Right. This was nobody came out with this stuff before, Bob. I'm sure that there are people who now say, oh, yeah, that was well known. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. Right. So how did he know all this stuff?
Right.
You know?
Right. We could talk about Bob probably in several different interviews, but we're going to try to jump around here a little bit.
Okay.
You got interested in an area in Utah called the Skinwalker Ranch, and I'm just kind of curious how that garnered your interest. Did Colum contact you, or had you already known about it prior?
Well, I had known about it for a while because there's a guy here in Las Vegas, a very wealthy businessman named Robert Bigelow, who's had an ongoing interest in paranormal and UFO topics for a long time. In fact, the first time he called me was the night we revealed the identity of Bob Lazar, and I got this call out of the blue from Mr. Bigelow, who said, hey, that's really interesting. I'm interested in UFOs. How can I help? And he wanted to offer financial support, which, of course, I turned down because I work for a TV station. Bob subsequently started financing all sorts of UFO research, cattle mutilations, things of that sort. He put up a $1 million prize at one point if all the major UFO organizations would come together and get along, which would prove to be impossible. And then he funded something called NIDS, the National Institute for Discovery Science. He put together a world-class science advisory board. I mean, really high-level guys, many of whom have worked for intelligence agencies and had an interest in this but could never express it. World-class scientists. He put together like a rapid response team. Colum Kelleher was part of that. People who could jump on a plane, take a bunch of equipment, go to the site of a UFO hotspot or outbreak or a cattle mutilation or something like that, and investigate, do good, hard scientific investigation. So NIDS is the group that heard about the Utah ranch about the same time I did, because there was a story in the Associated Press about this ranch, and I think there was a photo of the rancher with these giant scoop marks of soil that had been taken out of his pasture land with no explanation, almost like a cookie cutter kind of a pattern. NIDS got interested in it. They flew up to meet the rancher. By the time they met the rancher and his family, this family was in bad shape. They'd been through like 20 months of absolute terror. By the time NIDS got there, every member of the family, this two kids, the wife and the rancher, were sleeping at night on the floor in the same room, sort of for protection. I mean, they were messed up by the cavalcade of paranormal stuff that had happened to them. So Bigelow bought the ranch, and he sent this team of scientists up there, and they set up camp and installed all kinds of camera and monitoring gear, and they had basically a 24-hour presence on the property. They did basic scientific research to eliminate possible explanations. They checked for geomagnetic anomalies. They looked for plants or animal life with hallucinogenic properties. They did an ever-widening circle of interviews with the people who lived there, with the people who lived around it, with the Native Americans, with people in the community, and put together this pile of information to indicate that this place had been an absolute hotbed of paranormal UFO activity for 50 years at least, and probably a lot longer. And as they have these scientists up there, they start seeing things for themselves. Very, very strange experiences. I think you guys talked to Colum Kelleher sometime in the recent past, and he told you about some of them. Yeah. As these reports are coming in, because I'm friends with Bob Bigelow and Colum, I get to see them, but on the condition that I can't say anything about it. So this went on for years, driving me absolutely crazy. You know, I mean, I'm a news guy. I want to tell him, but I could never get permission to do anything with it, so I sat on it and bit my tongue, and it just drove me nuts. But eventually, whatever this phenomena was, it seemed to get tired of being stalked. It liked messing with people's heads. It had a real trickster quality to it, like scaring the hell out of the folks who lived there and the scientists and everyone else. But when the scientists started stalking it and trying to establish communication or a rapport or find out what it was, it sort of went underground. And when it finally went totally underground, almost totally, NID sort of closed up shop, figured they'd come back some other time, and that's when they gave me permission to go ahead and write about it.
You know, what I really find amazing is how people get together. Now, did you know Colum before you got together for this project?
No. No, I met Colum when he was hired to work at NIDS. Well, I knew Bigelow. I knew Bigelow quite a bit, and I knew a couple of other guys that were associated with his science advisory board, only sort of in passing. But I met Colum strictly through NIDS, and we got to work together on a variety of TV specials that I did, most of them dealing with cattle mutilation things. Also did some stuff on NIDS, had done some research into these giant flying triangles, and they would share with me information that could be made public, and I get the first crack at it because I treated it fairly and responsibly, and so we developed a pretty good relationship.
Did you did you personally participate in any of the experiments out there at the ranch?
No, not while the study was in full bloom. I subsequently I've been there more than a dozen times since. My first visit was in 2002, and I was an experiment. There were certain things that Colum had told me. There were certain things that got the entity or the intelligence, whatever it was. There are certain things that would happen that would get it riled up. So he figures, look, it's been kind of quiet here for a while. Let's do this. One of the things that would get it riled up is the arrival of strangers, and you make your presence known. Another would be you make a bunch of noise out in the pasture. And the thing that really got it going would be if you dig in the ground. There had been this prohibition from the previous owner. Hey, you can't dig in the ground unless we tell you ahead of time that it's okay. And the rancher thought it was weird, and NIDS thought it was weird. But they subsequently learned that there was something going on underground up there. So whenever they would do any serious digging or earth moving, they would have activity. So I'm there on my first visit, and they decided, well, look, you're a weird guy. You have a certain weirdness quotient. Let's see if this thing reacts to you. So they got the earth mover out and moved around a bunch of dirt on the property. We built a fire out on the pasture, made a bunch of noise, and whooped it up and did some interviews and made our presence known. And then they took a little plastic white chair and stuck me out in the middle homestead and left me there in the middle of the night.
And had all their cameras turned on you, probably.
Yeah, exactly, from a couple hundred yards away. And I think they were probably drinking beer and having a party or something while I'm stuck out there in the middle of nowhere. Now, this spot where they left me was a bad spot. Some bad stuff had happened there, including this predator-like creature that came out of the bushes. There have been a couple of mutilations there. This was the spot where the tunnel of light had appeared, and this giant Bigfoot thing had crawled out of it. So there's some bad things that had happened there, and it's all going through my mind as I was sitting there for a while. Unfortunately, nothing came to get me but mosquitoes. Well, I should say fortunately, I guess.
Yeah, fortunately.
I'd like to tell you that I was very, very brave, and I was never scared one bit, and that's just not true.
We've got some personal stories along those same lines anyway, but it doesn't have to do with the Skinwalker Ranch. Well, before we get into the member questions, you know, it's interesting that you have a shared interest with another guest of Johnny's and mine a few months back, Miss Shirley MacLaine. We had a fabulous interview with Shirley, and one of the things that Shirley's very passionate about is something that I'd like to ask you about, and that's Billy Meier. You know, Shirley, of course, is a huge, staunch supporter of Billy Meier. She spent several weeks with him and would take anybody to task that his story was not absolutely 100% truthful. But there's a lot of mudslinging in Georgia going on, finger-pointing, you know, screaming about Billy Meier and this and Billy Meier that. And I understand at one point you decided to look into this whole Billy Meier case. And I was just curious, what made you want to look into it? And what did you find out when you started investigating?
Well, one reason to look into it was the shape of the saucers. When I was first talking to Lazar and interviewing him, he said, you know what these things look like? The sport model is what his term was for the one that he saw fly. He says, you know what it looked like? It looked like these posters that Billy Meier has out. It's the same poster that Fox Mulder uses, like, I forget what the truth is out there.
I want to believe.
That's it. It's that saucer. He says, listen, this is what it looked like. I thought, well, I don't know much about Billy Meier, so I started reading it. I think it was Gary Kinder's book that I read, and I thought, well, this is pretty interesting. And then I contacted Wendell Stevens and Lee Elders and Britt Elders, who had been the principal investigators who'd gone over, and I found them to be pretty reasonable people. The Elders are private investigators. They put a lot of work into trying to figure out how Meier could have faked it. It just struck me as that this hadn't been given a fair shake, and that, you know, already that early in my research and my experience with ufology, I was already seeing that it was not uncommon for controversial topics to not be given a fair shake. In this case, it wasn't given a fair shake by ufology, and I think that's partly Billy Meier's fault, because he sort of shunned MUFON and some of those folks and wasn't willing to share information, so that automatically raises their antenna and their suspicions. But he had reason for that. I think that there are unanswered questions, and I'm sort of on the fence about him because, you know, it is a pretty difficult thing, I think, to make some of those early photos for a one-armed guy with the kind of equipment that he had. I'm also intrigued by his background. I mean, he had a pretty interesting life and had experiences with UFOs and saucers and things like that over much of his life in different countries, not just there. I found that interesting, too. And then, you know, and later as his story started growing in Europe, it seemed like he attracted a lot of different kinds of people. And some of those people, I think, infiltrated his organization as sort of a commune and family there and did not have good intentions.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of those later photos of his that just look ridiculous. They look like
the ray gunman.
Yeah, and that thing with the balls on the bottom, and it just looks ridiculous. It looks like a wedding cake.
Right.
They just look ridiculous. And, don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're nothing like the quality of those earlier ones. So I don't know if there was a concentrated effort to discredit Billy Meyer. That would not surprise me because it's happened in a lot of really interesting stories, Gulf Breeze, MJ-12, a lot of things like that, and even Roswell. You know, suddenly the waters get muddied by people who seem to be a lot better at muddying waters than people like us are at getting to the truth.
Right.
And so that's I sort of have him in my gray basket. I'm not a staunch supporter, but I remain open-minded about it.
Okay,
so and Johnny and I do too.
Yeah, so the jury's still out as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, I think so. I really think that the early stuff seems legit.
Before we get to our member questions, one last question. There was obviously, other than just Stevensville, we had another event that just happened in Denver, Colorado, with the alien video being shown there. What did you get a chance to view that, and what is your take on it?
Yeah, I saw it. I'll be charitable. I'll put that in the gray basket too, because all I've seen is an online version of it. I haven't seen everything that's went with it. I did get a call from someone associated with that who had left a message for me and saying that they needed some money. They were out of money and wanted to see if I could help them finish their production. And I called back a couple of times to see what was going on, and they never called me back. So I don't know. It seems incredibly fortuitous to catch something like that on a camera peeking in your window. On the other hand, I mean, that blinking eyeball stuff, that's pretty good. Whoever did it is pretty good. But, of course, I remember the alien autopsy video, and that was pretty good to an extent. But I looked at that, and I thought, well, this is ridiculous. And that chewed up, a couple of years of time?
Right.
Of everybody arguing about it?
Right.
I hope the same thing doesn't happen with this alien in the window. I'll reserve judgment, I guess, until they actually release all the video and we get to see more of it. But right now, I'm leaning more to the skeptical side.
Okay.
Well, all right. Let's get into the member questions, because the members are really just chomping at the bits. If we don't ask some of these questions, they're going to just really take us to task, George.
Okay.
First member question is from a member by the name of Sky Floating. And he says, George, what's the best thing that's ever happened to you in the context of your UFO research?
Well, it's probably the Skinwalker stuff. I mean, I've enjoyed every bit of it, every bit of the journey. I've got to travel all over the world and meet some really interesting people. But the Skinwalker stuff has opened my eyes in a way that just this straight UFO story has not. Because, I mean, this is everything. It's UFOs and poltergeist activity and crop circles and animal mutilations and strange creatures all rolled into one with the Indian mythology and legend. And it seems to me that this entity or intelligence, this trickster or whatever, is trying to tell us something. It's trying to lead us down a path that, to a simple message that our understanding of the universe, the world around us, is far more complicated, far more wondrous than we can imagine, and that maybe we need to start thinking about it in different terms. I think that it represents a paradigm shift. It certainly has changed the way I look at the world and life in general. If, in fact, this turns out that the explanation for what goes on at that ranch is parallel dimensions, other people living in and around us, that maybe that we're the aliens or we're the ants, that they see what we can do and we can't see them, they enter our world, we can't enter theirs, that's going to be a very, very profound change in human consciousness if and when it ever permeates out to a larger audience. It certainly has affected me.
We just interviewed Dr. Michio Kaku the other day, and one of the things that struck me as you were talking was he seems to think that ultra-dimensional creatures, aliens, maybe even ourselves, seem to possibly operate in a different frequency, and they may be present, they may even be in our own studios right now, but we can't see them because of them being in a different frequency.
I'm sort of in the same spot. I read a couple of his books in preparation for the Skinwalker stuff, and that is sort of what helped lead us down to that kind of a conclusion, that it's going to be disturbing, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, tremendously, yeah.
Yeah. Another member by the name of Teza JW asks this, do you have any information, George, about bases in Australia, particularly, say, Pine Gap, which supposedly is similar in function to Area 51?
Well, I've heard it mentioned many times here on this side, the comparisons between the same kind of research going on at both places. That's an American base in the middle of nowhere in Australia. I got a chance to visit Australia last June and ask some of the UFO researchers and paranormal researchers down there. They're of the same opinion. There are a whole lot of UFO sightings in that area. There's a lady who lives in the town right outside the area, that area, who sends me photos all the time. A lot of the same kind of stuff that you see about in association with Area 51. If you're asking me, do I have an inside source who's told me about it, the answer is no. I think it's a really intriguing place. The fact that Americans have such a strong presence down there is intriguing to me, and maybe that would be the kind of place where you'd stash your flying saucers if Area 51 became too hot, but right. I can't prove it.
Sure.
Right. All right, member of the Borg. George, I was just wondering if you could comment a bit about two of the most recent sightings that have occurred. One, the Stephenville mass sighting, and the one that one of the AboveTopSecret.com owners, Springer, a.k.a. Mark Allen, tried to uncover at the Chicago O'Hare Airport last October.
Well, the Stephenville thing is really interesting. I mean, it's multiple sightings, not just one, and I don't claim to be an expert. I've interviewed a lot of the people who've been involved in it, including the newspaper reporter from down there who broke the story. I think that's an example of what I was talking about before, about how the people who muddy these waters, who cast doubt, are a lot better at their job than we are at ours, because that thing has been so hopelessly muddled with all the counter-explanations. However, it persists. Yesterday, I read this new report that was put out by a MUFON, which analyzes radar returns from that area, and man, it's good. It's really good. It's pretty clear that they did scramble jets, that they were chasing something, that there was something else that sort of appeared on radar, and I think that's a legitimate case. And we don't know really what the answer is yet, but it certainly is legitimate that there was a genuine unexplained phenomena there. And, you know, all those witnesses who've been slapped around for seeing what they know their eyes saw, I applaud them for sticking to their guns.
Boy, I do too.
And O'Hare, the O'Hare case is a really, it's a great case. Here's the only comment I'll make about that, because I haven't done any firsthand research into its legitimacy, but it's interesting to me as a media professional that the Chicago newspaper does that story, and they get more response to that story than anything they've done in 10 years.
Yep.
And yet it does not prompt them to do more. You know, and I've seen that over and over again. CBS News has been here a couple of times and tried to do UFO shows, ABC as well. The correspondents who work on these kind of things, it drives them crazy. They think it's a career killer for them to work on these things, even though invariably, those shows get the biggest ratings that those news programs ever have. Why do you think Larry King keeps doing UFOs over and over? Chicago, the newspaper up there, gets more hits on their website about this UFO thing than anything they've done. Does that prompt them to do more UFO stuff? Apparently not.
Yeah.
You know, all these shows, History Channel, A&E, Discovery, they all love to cash in on the quick rating spurt that you get from UFOs, and then they always cop out. At the end of the show, they give some debunker who has some standard answer and dismisses stuff with some weak, unfounded explanation that can easily be disproven. Those guys get the last word, and the guys who could easily answer that stuff don't. And it just really ticks me off, which is why I don't cooperate with that stuff anymore. I don't do those shows anymore.
Right.
Yeah, bravo, George.
Member Carl Hungus says this, given what you've seen and what you know, are you frightened about the future, or are you eagerly to watch everything unfold?
Well, it drives me crazy that maybe, you know, I might end my life and my life might end and I still won't have any answers to this stuff. I've seen a lot of these old-time UFO guys who've given decades of their life to pursuing the mystery and they die and they still don't have any definitive answer. And I suspect that will be the case with me as well and maybe with you young guys. But because I don't see that this phenomenon, which, you know, whatever this presence is, it is the architect of the secrecy. It's, you know, our government covers up some stuff, but if they, whoever they are, wanted to show it to us, they could do it, because they do show it on occasion to here and there. So it's frustrating to me in that sense. I would like to be around long enough to know the answers, because I'm nosy by nature. I am worried about the future for a whole other bunch of reasons, mostly dealing with things that we humans do to each
right.
other.
Well, there were several things that I enjoyed about your answer on that. One was that you called Dave and I young guys.
Yeah.
But I got to disagree on one hand here. If you were to pass away, heaven forbid that happens, I still think that what you are doing, sir, is actually adding to a larger piece of the puzzle. And without guys like you, we would not be able to have a clearer look at the jigsaw puzzle in itself.
Well, I appreciate that, and I hope that's true. You know, that the stuff in Area 51, that will remain controversial forever, and we'll probably never get a serious answer to that until maybe, you know, I don't think that they're going to open the doors and let us come in and kick the tires on the saucers or anything anytime soon, because I think a lot of those guys would go to jail for the stuff that
right.
they've done.
Oh, sure.
And then again, on the Skinwalker stuff, I think that that is a first step toward a greater understanding of the world around us, and I am very proud to be part of that work.
You know, for whatever it's worth, I'm just pushing 60 young man, George.
Oh, okay.
And 50 on this end.
Yeah, I started my radio career in at 58, George. So.
Well, geez, I'm talking to a couple of geezers here.
Hey, we are geezers, babe. But seriously, I mean, we'll probably die before you will, George. But I gotta say this before I ask this next question from the member. You know, just the things that you've done in the time that you've been alive has been such a marvelous contribution to get to the bottom and get to the facts and give the people at least some kind of hope or some kind of belief that, you know, that someone is fighting to find the truth to stuff. And I can't applaud you enough, George.
Well, thanks. I'm not done by any means. I mean, I have a very busy life, and I put in about 60 hours a week at the TV station. I write a column. I do some radio stuff, and I'm a busy guy, but this is a passion for me, as it is for you guys. And I got some good projects coming up in the next year, and if I get a chance, I'll come back and tell you about them when the time's right.
Oh, that'd be great.
All right, cool. All right, well, member Antar, speaking about your radio gig, wants to know, two-parter, do you enjoy your weekly, monthly gig at Coast to Coast, and do you think that you can ever get both our old friend Richard Dolan and Jacques Vallier together for a four-hour show?
Well, yeah, I enjoy it very much. I do it twice a month now, which is about all I can handle, but it's a hoot because, you know, I don't have to wear a suit and tie. That's number one. I wouldn't even have to wear pants, although I don't want to upset the audience about it. I do wear pants, generally. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I really like the format, because in 4 hours you can really get into something, you know. And I get more time for my TV stories than anybody else around here, but it's just not enough. And the same thing is like in a column; it's always more to get into. But 4 hours you can really get into some stuff, and the audience is challenging. Sometimes they have an on night, and they really are with you and bring their A game to the table, and it's a lot of fun. Dolan and Vallet, that would be a dream show. You know, I've known Jacques Vallet for a long time, and I don't know him all that well. We don't talk like we're best pals or anything, but I have a great deal of respect for him. I think he's just about the most important guy to ever tackle this topic, the deepest thinker, and his contributions, man, it's there's nothing comparable. Richard Dolan, I've known him for the last year or so, and interviewed him. I've been on the panels with him. He's a top-notch guy, great thinker. He's brought so much to the field. Having them together, that'd be a dream show. That's a great idea.
Yeah. I think we have maybe time for maybe two more questions here, Dave. I'm going to do a Hua, and why don't you do Golden Fleece?
I would love to do Golden Fleece.
Yeah. Member Hua wants to know, and by the way, we have absolutely no clue as to why some of these members choose names like they do. I have heard, George, from a few of my friends in Los Alamos, that in actuality, technology is 50 years ahead of what man is shown. Do you know this to be true?
I have been told that that is true, and I've been told it by a number of people. You know, in the course of the Area 51 stuff, I got to know a whole lot of people who worked at the base, who still work at the base, who have been able to publicly admit that they were out there. And I'll just tell you one person who said that we were 50 years ahead of anything that the public knows about is Ben Rich, is the guy from Lockheed. You know, one of the great aircraft designers of all time, who had a great interest in UFOs and who shared that interest in letters that some of them have now been made public. Ben Rich said that we already have the technology to go to the stars, that we have stuff out there that would make George Lucas drool, that whatever we can dream, we can already do, that we are easily 50 years ahead of anything that the public knows. And I believe that to be the case. I mean, I've heard it from enough people now whose opinions I respect and whose credentials are not questioned, that I believe that could be, yeah.
All right, last question, and then John's going to end this sucker. Remember Golden Fleece. Now, this is a perfect last question, John. Thank you for throwing this one to me.
You're welcome.
George, do you think media consolidation and or corporate government influence is so pervasive that ultimately the freedom of the press that we are enjoying, but gradually things are being pulled away, do you think it's in jeopardy?
Well, I'm concerned about it. I mean, this is not just my profession. This is my religion. I mean, the First Amendment is my religion, and it's been under assault in the last couple of years like never before. If you think about wireless surveillance of American citizens, where you don't need a warrant anymore, and you just have to take somebody's word for it that they're investigating terrorism, that scares me. It scares me things like torture. It scares me that journalists get thrown in jail and get fined $5,000 a day to force them to reveal their sources. That scares me. I hope that Congress addresses the issue of a federal shield law, because I can tell you from personal experience that it's kept me out of the poorhouse here in Las Vegas, having a state shield law. I don't know that media consolidation is the greatest threat. I would say it is a threat, and that it could eventually lead to limited choices and limited free flow of information. It hasn't, I haven't seen it in my own life. I haven't seen like a corporate decision, hey, you can't cover UFOs. And I know a lot of people in this arena think that the media, the TV media in particular, are controlled, that we are told what we can and cannot report. It does not happen as a result of government action. The government doesn't tell us we can't do a story on X or Y. But there are competitive pressures, there are advertiser pressures that are very real. And, yeah, I worry about it all the time.
You had mentioned earlier that you were working on a few things in the future, and as they unravel or unfold, perhaps you'll come back on here and tell us about it. Can you give us a little teaser about that? What is it that you're investigating right now that's garnering your interest?
Well, a lot of these things, it's a multi-part project, and it's stuff that I started years ago. I left the TV station to go to work for a private company that funded, basically let me loose for a couple of years to work on UFO stuff. I went to Russia and brought back several thousand pages of still classified material, and that hasn't seen the light of day. Did some crop circle stuff. I'm working on some animal mutilation stuff that I think is going to shake people up. This is going to be a multi-part project that will be available for everybody, and I don't want to make it sound like a commercial, but I think it's on the right path. It's the kind of thing that's needed right now to sort of clear the air on some of these topics, but it's going to cover a lot of ground, I'll put it that way.
Well, my buddy Ruben Uriarte contacted me last month, and he was telling me about some of the things that are going to be happening here on July 25th, and one of them was, I saw your name there. What is it you're going to be talking about at the big MUFON event on July 25th?
Well, MUFON Symposium, I'm very proud to be invited back to speak to him. I'm going to be talking about Skinwalker Ranch, and I've made a couple of public presentations about this before. What makes this one different is that I'm going to be paired with Colm Kelleher, because the conference is in the Bay Area up there next weekend. Colm and I are going to be on the same stage together and answering questions and talking about this. We're going to sort of kind of take on some of the criticisms that were leveled at the Skinwalker book. specifically about types of proof, because we've got a lot of physical evidence. A problem is, as you, if you guys read the book, you know, the right. problem is proof of what, you know, we're not trying right. to say what it proves because we don't have a thesis. We just don't know. So we're going to sort of take that head on and indicate what kinds of physical proof do exist. And then I do. I'm probably going to be the setup guy. And then Colm talks about the hard science of the whole thing. I think it's going to be fun. I really look forward to it, and I hope your listeners can get on up there and help support MUFON.
And so it is open to the public, right?
It is, sure, yeah. Tickets are cheap, and there's a whole pile of really interesting speakers from all over the world, and this is a top-notch event in this field.
Well, we know that you've got a newscast coming up here shortly, so we probably need to let you go, but I can't tell you how fun this has been for both Dave and I to have you on here, and I'm sure it's been a real kick for all our fans and listeners here at AboveTopSecret.com, George.
Well, thanks. Thanks to all the ATS listeners and the online folks, and it was a kick, and I hope you have me back sometime.
Oh, we would
we
love
will,
to.
George. And we really appreciate right. it, brother. You're a great guy. I don't care what everybody else says. We think we love you, George.
See you, fellas.
All right, George. Have a good one.
Take care,
Bye.
Man.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.abovetopsecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat.